math trauma is rooted in either an isolated traumatic experience that the student has had or a series of repeated traumas that have been building up over time. The way we heal from trauma is to create a safe space for people to explore their past experiences with math and simultaneously infuse it with new joyful experiences.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Vicaria, aka The Math Guru, and you're listening to Math Therapy, a podcast that explores the root causes of math trauma and the empowering ways we can heal from it. Whether you think you're a math person or not, you're about to find out that math people don't actually exist, but the scars that math class left on many of us definitely do. Oh, and don't worry, no calculators or actual math were involved in the making of this podcast. So, fun fact about today's guest. No, seriously, just take a minute to understand what I'm about to say to you. She has not uttered a single F word since eighth grade. So, like, for 30 years. And I felt like I had to come in hot with this juicy piece of news because, guys, today's episode is one of the only episodes that does not contain a single iota of salty language. Can you believe it? Very exciting stuff. Rip those earmuffs off of your kids and tell them to tune in. Today, I'm chatting with the incomparable Liesl McConchy, an international expert on how the brain learns and co-author of best-selling book, Brain-Based Learning. This is our fifth season, and until now, I've never actually spoken to anyone about the relationship between math learning, math trauma, and our actual brains. And today, I am speaking with the best of the best. Liesl blew my flippin' mind. See what I did there? During this convo, and I know you're going to be blown away too. Let's do this. Liesl, welcome to the podcast. I am so excited to have you here. Ever since we met in a dingy hallway, well, it wasn't dingy, but ever since we met while I was sitting on the floor eating a sandwich in a hallway.
It was kind of dark.
It was dimly lit for sure. Okay, yeah. So I have to say, we have never had a brain scientist. You're a brain scientist, right? I can call you a brain scientist?
Well, it depends on how you define a brain scientist. I don't have like a PhD in neuroscience, but... So, I mean, you know, like seriously, like how do you define someone who is something? Like I study brain science. I might consider myself like a translator. I translate brain science for people who work in education.
Okay, well, that's amazing. I'm so excited to have a brain science translator in education on my podcast. And let's get right into it. Can you tell us what brain-based learning is? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, sure. I mean, brain-based learning, I consider it to be the most student-centered way of approaching teaching and learning. Mm. So it's about understanding how the brain naturally learns, how it naturally operates, and then using that information to make informed decisions to maximize student learning.
I mean, I love it. It's so funny because it's like, oh, that sounds so obvious, but am I wrong in saying like we don't do that in most classrooms?
You are not wrong. We do not do that in those classrooms, which is why I'm here and why I have a job.
I guess like just backing up, I mean, I've read a lot of your work and I've heard you on a lot of podcasts. And every time you speak about brain-based learning, obviously there are a ton of facets we'll get into. But what it made me actually think of right away, and I kind of want you to just do this first on the podcast. So math therapy, like, yes, it's a podcast, but it's also PD I do. And it's actually like a way of meeting your math trauma face to face. And there are steps mm-hmm. to math therapy. So you can do it in the classroom, you can do it to yourself, whatever, fine. But the first step is all about growth mindset. And I find myself now, every time I bring it up with teachers, I'm like, okay, so step number one is to set up an environment where growth mindset is just an obvious in your classroom. Oh, I don't have to go into this. We all know it. We've all been talking about it. Let's move on. And lately I've been like, hold on a second. You know, when you like talk about something so much, you just assume everyone knows what you're talking about. And yes. I feel like we've like said the term growth mindset so often, but I have never, at least on this podcast, spoken about how it actually works, not just as a like woo-woo mindset, but like in terms of how the brain works. Can you get into that with us?
Yes, I'd love to. You're so right. Because I feel like it's kind of morphed and, you know, this is mm-hmm. what happens. Some new idea or new research comes out and then the education system just like squeezes it and twists it and like messes with it like Play-Doh. And then all of a sudden it's like, boop, it just becomes this poster on a wall.
Totally.
And that's growth mindset, which is not what it is at all. So growth mindset, the term, of course, was coined by Carol Dweck out of Stanford University. But the idea has been around for a long time, but long enough for our lifetime. She basically just put a nice term. She like just labeled.
It's a very catchy term.
Sure. Like, it's right? very catchy term.
Clickbait. Love it.
And yeah, so it's all rooted in the science of neuroplasticity is the fancy scientific term for it. Because before you and I were born, the accepted belief was the brain that you're born with is the brain that you die with and that your brain doesn't change. And so the idea of neuroplasticity, once they were able, the technology developed enough to be able to track and monitor and be like, hold on a second. Like it was revolutionary in the field of cognitive neuroscience. People are like, what? Our brains actually can change? There was a lot of resistance to
it. Sorry, can I like interrupt so quickly to be like, how did people possibly think the brain you had when you were like a baby was the same brain?
I don't know.
Like, how does that even make sense? Okay, fine, whatever. We thought the earth was flat. Some people still do. Okay,
sure.
Whatever.
Right, there's a lot of crazy things that we could, like, people used
okay,
to.
Okay, fine.
Right, yeah. So neuroplasticity is the science that says our brains change. So the brain that actually you woke up with this morning is going to be different than your brain in an hour when we're done chatting today. Because you and I are going to change each other's brains.
Wait, stop. That's actually very cool. I didn't even think of it happening on such like a micro, small, minute by minute level.
100%. Okay, it's already happened.
Oh my God,
it's already happened.
Okay.
And why I think neuroplasticity is the most important concept for teachers to understand and people who work with kids is because it is a message of hope.
God, stop. I love this. I love this. Okay, go
on.
Sorry.
It's the hope. It's the message of hope that we all need. Like, hey, if I'm struggling with math right now, this isn't set in stone. My destiny is not determined. I can change. My brain can change. My abilities can change.
Wow.
And so when we can infuse that hope in students, then amazing things can happen because hopelessness is one of the most tragic neurobiological states for a learner to be in. Nothing's going to happen when a student's in a state of hopelessness.
Wait, hopelessness is a neurobiological state?
Yes, yes. So like it's not a mood. Moods last longer, but states are like these micro moods basically. And so right now you're in a state of curiosity because you're like, wait, hold on, what? And curiosity is one of the most amazing states to be in for learning to happen. But students and learners and people in general, we are constantly ebbing and flowing in and out of states all day long. Confusion, curiosity, hunger, anger, frustration, anxiety, confident. And some states help us, help the brain to be able to learn better. And some really, you know, each state releases its own unique like ingredient of cocktails. It's like a cocktail, right? It's like all these different... Okay. Clearly I don't drink and I don't know what I'm talking about.
I don't drink either. No, but I was thinking it's like a mocktail. It is.
Sure. Okay. We'll talk mocktails.
Yeah, 100%.
So, each state, whether it's anxiety or confidence or hopelessness or hopefulness, each one has its own signature recipe of neurochemicals and hormones that get released in the brain that activate or deactivate different parts of the brain. It does all these crazy, fancy stuff that ultimately makes it easier or harder for a person to learn and grow.
What is the difference between a state and a mood?
Oh, mostly it's time. Mostly it's time.
Like the duration?
Yes. Yes. So states last for seconds, maybe minutes.
Oh.
And a mood can be a prolonged state. And so the longer that you're in a state, if you stay stuck in a state, it can turn into a mood. And yeah, that's the short
version. Is depression a state?
Yes. And a mood.
Like, I'm actually wondering, it's so interesting because it feels like a state is something that's more, and I'm using air quotes, scientific. You're talking about chemicals, you're talking about these ingredients, whereas a mood feels more like, I don't know what the word is, ethereal or like something more like woo-woo. Like, it feels almost like a mood is something you should be able to snap out of versus a state where you're like, nope, you're in an actual neurological condition.
Well,
am I wrong?
I don't know if I say that you're wrong. I mean, in my book, Brain-Based Learning, there's a whole chapter on emotions, and we break out the differences between an emotion, a state, and a mood. So states are reinforcing. It's like tire tracks in a muddy road kind of thing, like wagon ruts. And so the longer you're in a state, the more comfortable that is for you and your brain to be in, so you're more easily to slip in it. So when students are consistently in a state of hopelessness, specifically like in a math class, if we're going to talk about math here,
yeah,
then it's easier over time for them to slip into that. Mm. It takes less of a trigger for them mm-hmm. to slip into that. And so same thing with depression. Depression can be just a short term, like, oh, I'm just kind of like feeling really depressed today. And then that state can change. But if you continue to stay in or have reoccurring moments or minutes with depression, that it becomes easier and easier for you to get into a depressed mood. And then it can become clinical depression, which is why whenever we feel it, it's okay, it's normal, but we don't want to get too comfortable and stay there too long.
So, okay. We don't want to, yeah. Right. Because I know that completely makes sense, like how you're talking about the tire tracks. And I guess, so I want to go in two different directions here. So we're going to just do both. The first thing I was actually thinking, the reason I was speaking about moods that way, I think it's the language that I'm kind of getting hung up on, because I'm like, you know, whenever we talk about mindset and growth mindset, we're going to get more into neuroplasticity in a second. But I find that there is a chunk of a segment of the population that's just like, ugh, like mindset, come on, like kind of eye rolling and being like, what even is that? Like the idea of just getting in a different math mindset? No, you just need to learn math. You just need to practice more, like this kind of idea. And I wonder if it's actually because we're talking about it in a non-scientific way so often. Like something I was going to say to you before we even started recording, but I'll just say now, is like a lot of my background is in mindfulness. So that's like, I find that, yes, I might not know about the brain science of things, but so much of my work and my studying has been in like mindful-based stress reduction, in meditation, and all of those things that merge in a weird way with growth mindset, but in a way that I feel can come off as kind of like hippie vibes.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but there's so much science behind it. Mindfulness is one of the most powerful ways to transition from a negative state, or one that doesn't serve a learning brain, into a more positive state. So when someone's feeling anxious or hopelessness, mindfulness practices really help bring students or a learner, a person back into a state of feeling calm and centered and confident and just in control, because mindfulness is the act of, you know, controlling your mind and your breathing. And that brings you back into, okay, I have control over this. I can be in charge of myself and my learning, whereas hopelessness and anxiety feels so external.
So circling back to neuroplasticity, can you tell us how it all kind of ties together?
So neuroplasticity is this science that supports Carol Dweck's work,
okay,
that abilities can change. Nothing is set in stone or static. And it is a message of hope that puts us in a state to be able to learn. And so when I work with teachers, I talk a lot more about neuroplasticity because that's more of my area of expertise. And I actually show videos of students doing a math problem. And I say, how many different states can you identify just in this 2-minute video? And you can watch a learner go from curious to frustrated to confident. And that just shows that it's constantly changing.
And so neuroplasticity is like literally your brain, without getting too into the science. It is like, could you do a quick science summary of what it means?
Yes. It's the science that says your brain can and does change.
Okay. Amazing.
All the time.
Amazing. Amazing. So, okay, it seems like, I am going to use a really obnoxious pun, but like, it does seem like a no-brainer that given that we should, David's shaking his head.
But
I even wrote it down. I was like, it's going to be so good. Liesl's going to love this. It seems like a no-brainer that we should be, it's like, okay, look, it's been proven. It's scientifically proven. Like, to me, I'd be like, oh, our brains are constantly changing. That should mean there's no such thing as this myth of the math person. There's no such thing as a math gene.
Yes.
So what's up? Why is that? I literally did a talk for parents last week and I asked to the room, I said, how many of you believe that you're either born good at math or born bad at math? And half of them raised their hands.
No.
Half.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
And I was like, what? So
where does this even come from?
Well, I mean, we don't have time for that, but I mean, it serves a segment of the population to keep believing that, let's be honest. But given everything you're saying, also, sorry, I have a very quick question because you probably know the answer. Carol Dweck, you just said that neuroplasticity is the science that supports Carol Dweck's research. Was she, like, I actually really don't know, when she came up with all of this stuff, was it based in brain science or did that come after?
Yeah. I mean, she knows, she's very well versed in brain science and neuroplasticity. I mean, she didn't like discover neuroplasticity or anything like that, but she just really great marketing in coining a really catchy term.
But she was using it from the onset of being like growth mindset. She was like, right away, it's rooted in brain science.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So fast forward to now. So what is going on and why do people still say things like math person? Why is it so hard for people to believe what you're saying?
Okay.
You're very convincing. So, you sound knowledgeable.
Thank you. First of all, let's take it from the words of my 8-year-old. So this morning, as I was preparing for this podcast, my 8-year-old was like, what is your podcast about today anyway? What are you talking about? And so I was telling him a couple things. I was like, well, one of the things we're going to talk about is this whole thing of, you know, some people believe that people are born really good at math and that there's like this actual gene that makes you good at math. And others believe that that's not true, that you can get better at math. And he's like, well, that's an easy question. He's like, of course it's the second one. And I was like, that's right. Yeah. You know, so this really isn't that hard to believe. So, okay, let's get into it. First of all, I want to say this. When people talk about whether there is a genetic disposition to math or not, what I really want to say is, I don't care.
I don't care.
Because let's just play devil's advocate and let's say that there is. There isn't, but let's say that there is. What are you going to do with that information?
Well, I feel like, I mean, is this rhetorical? Or are you asking?
No, like for real. Okay, so here we go. Here's your class list, math teacher. And I have done genetic testing on your students. And I know which ones have this math gene and which ones don't. What are you going to do with this information?
But I feel like that we have a history of doing stuff with this information that's very bad.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. No good is going to come from
it. No good is going to come from it.
You're going to track your students. Yeah. You're going to label them. You're going to treat them differently.
Yes.
It's going to be a repetition of that 1960s, whatever it was, study with the Rosenthal effect, where they arbitrarily put students in two different classes, but told the teachers, hey, you got all the smart, high scoring students. And these students aren't so smart. And you're going to replicate that same study, which
you
actually-
Tell us what happened in the end.
Okay, so two things happened. So they tested all the kids and then randomly assigned them into two different groups, okay? But told the teachers, you got all the smart kids, you got all the not smart kids. Well, what happened is what you would anticipate happening, that the students who were randomly assigned to a teacher who was told that they had all of the smart, high-performing students, they outperformed all of the students over here in the other class who had a teacher who were told that they weren't smart. And so there's two big things that we can learn from this study. One is that teacher expectations can be manipulated. Which is what happens with all this research about a math gene, is that all you're doing is you're manipulating teachers' expectations. You're confirming their biases around who's good at math and who's not. And then the other thing that happened is that we learned that teacher expectations impact student achievement.
Right.
Which means you're hurting kids. So basically, if you want to buy into the math gene theory, what you're going to be doing is confirming a bias that some kids are better than others, and you're going to be hurting kids.
But what about like the kids or the adults who hang on? I've had people say something like, well, if there's no math gene, what's my excuse for being bad at math? The idea of any sort of mathematical ability being rooted in genetics in literally any way would be so, so, so minor that it's not significant. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Like there are regions of the brain that are highly associated with some types of mathematical computations. It's not all math lives in one part of the brain. That's ridiculous. That's very old school thinking. And also, I got a lot of questions about how they're actually studying it, because it's like,
totally,
they're testing math abilities in like 3 to 6 year olds. And then a little bit later on, don't tell me that like a 3 to 6 year old hasn't already been exposed to a tremendous amount of math already in their environment.
And messaging and like all sorts of stuff.
Sure. I mean, I got a 4-year-old and he can already tell you like all the square numbers up to 100 and he knows what they mean. That is not because he has a genetic disposition. That's because he is immersed in an environment where there's a lot of math going on, because he has older siblings, because he has a mother that loves math, and because we play a lot of math games. He's exposed to a lot of math manipulatives in his playroom. And so they're all of the environmental factors are far, far, far more significant to someone's mouth ability than this little thing right here.
So, okay, I need to actually clear this up with somebody. The whole, you know how everyone's always like left brain, right brain, left brain, right brain. That's like nonsense, right?
Right. Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. I'm so glad because I always bring that up as an example. I'm like, it's actual BS. Like, I don't know why we keep saying it, but people keep saying it. Okay, great. Anyways. Okay. That being said, are we going to talk about epigenetics right now? You told me to bring it up. Okay. So let's go. What is it? Go.
Okay. So
I'm putting so much pressure on you. I'm like, Lisa.
No, I love it. So let's just say epigenetics is this really new, very, very new, exciting field in neuroscience that explains how your environment and experiences that you have in life literally alter the way in which your genes are expressing themselves. Oh. So we have to like go back to like biology classes. So it literally is changing your genetic makeup, which genes are being expressed, which genes are turned on, which genes are turned off. And so even if there is like this tiny little bit of genetic heritability of like this one little kind of computational arithmetic math, it all can change. The way that I'm raising my children is literally altering the way their genes are going to be expressed.
Whoa. That's so, I didn't even know that was a thing.
It is. And this is why people talk about how trauma is inheritable. So like the trauma.
Like generational trauma.
Yes. Yes. Because it is altering the genetic makeup of the offspring.
Pause.
And how those genes are expressed.
What? Yep. What?
Yes. So even if people want to buy into the math gene, fine. I mean, not fine.
But even
if you do, then, well, you can't change that. Let's focus on the things that we do have influence over. Let's create an environment where we can express and amplify the mathematical abilities that we all have within us. We can literally fix this whole like math person thing, by creating amazing, enriching experiences for students that are healing of whatever math trauma might be passed down, math anxiety that might be passed down, and of course, their ability.
Okay, we have to go. I mean, because this is a podcast about math trauma. I mean, I need to just get rid of all the personal questions I have for my own benefit. I want to talk about math trauma, okay? And this idea of generational trauma, this idea of math trauma, I speak about it a lot, but I very rarely focus on what's actually happening in the brain. So when we started this conversation, we weren't recording, but as a summary, we were talking about like, oh my gosh, there's so little out there. There's so little research about trauma and how it affects learning, especially learning math, right? Like that's not to put words in your mouth. We were saying that. And what I was thinking is because I actually feel like it is only recently, first of all, this whole idea of socio-emotional learning, the idea of looking as a student, as a whole person that isn't just like some robot, it's fairly new, right?
Which is what?
It's wild, of course, but it's like, it is fairly new. Even like the way we're talking about mental health now is completely new, right? We wouldn't have been using the word trauma 5 years ago. People would have been like, what? Mm-hmm. Trauma has to mean something so extreme that universally, collectively, we can agree on the word. So I actually think the discourse around it has changed. And now we're kind of scrambling to catch up. I think no one has taken it seriously before. Again, like even when I started this podcast 3 years ago, people were like, math trauma, that seems like a bit much. Whereas now you're hearing it more. So I actually want to talk about this with you. Like, what did you find when you were looking into it? When you hear math trauma and when you're thinking about what's actually going on in the brain, what's happening for you? That was 30 questions.
Yeah, that was. Okay. So remind me of the ones that I missed. Okay. So what did I find? What I found was nothing.
Wow.
I found nothing. I cannot find any research on math trauma. So if anyone listening has any, please pass it my way. I'm trying to learn more about it. What there is a ton of research on trauma in different contexts. Yeah. And so being able to read and decipher all of that and then translate it into a context of math is not a big leap. There just isn't anything that's already written out there that I have been able to find yet. So math anxiety and math and trauma are two different things. So we need to make sure we separate these two.
Let's do that. Yes.
So math anxiety is just the feeling of anxiousness. Okay. So anxiety is a state. Going back to that, anxiety can be short-lived. I can feel math anxiety in the moments before a test or some other kind of an assessment. and then it can leave me. And some people, like we talked about those ruts in the road, some people can fall into that state of anxiety real quickly and they stay there a lot because of past math experiences and things like that. Now, math trauma is rooted in either an isolated traumatic experience that the student has had or a series of repeated traumas that have been building up over time. Now, trauma is stored in the brain completely different than other things, than the rest of life experiences that we have. Completely different. Yeah. It's so fascinating, Vanessa. I get so,
like, what are you
totally nerding out right now.
I love nerd okay. out.
Let me see if I can keep this pretty simple. So in a normal life experience, let's say, like, Vanessa, what's something that you did over this weekend that you'd be willing to share?
What have I done? I've recorded podcast interviews. Well, I did some singing lessons. I practiced my vocal range.
Okay. So when you're at your singing, so like that happened and everything that happened as you were like going to wherever singing lessons happened.
And I couldn't hit the note. I was really upset. Does that help with the trauma?
We're not talking trauma yet. We're talking non-trauma things.
Non-trauma. Okay.
So that stuff gets inputted into the brain. And what happens is it passes through your amygdala, which is your emotional control center of the brain. And it acts kind of like TSA at the airport, where it's like this screening system. And if there's anything that is a perception of fear or anxiety or any kind of stress or any kind of perception of threat, the amygdala like sets off the alarms. Burp, 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 burp. And because the brain is designed for survival and not school learning, which is a huge misunderstanding that people don't understand. Like, why can't they just learn it? Because the brain is not designed to learn math. The brain's designed to keep you alive.
Oh my God.
And so if there's something that is threatening you or is creating anxiety in you, your brain is going to shut everything else down and handle this because people try to like push emotions away and try to ignore them. No, they are central to who we are and how we learn. And so the amygdala acts like TSA and filters all of this. And let's just say like singing lessons, everything's, you know, going fine. And then what happens is that information then gets like into your hippocampus. It gets spread out to all these different parts of your brain. The pictures get put in one place and there's sounds of you singing in a different place. And what you're doing with your body goes somewhere else. And so all of our memories are stored all over the place in our brain. So when we try to remember something, when I say like, hey, think back to when you had your music lesson, whoosh, all those pieces come back together like puzzle pieces to rebuild this memory. That's how normal experiences happen.
Okay.
Trauma, totally different.
What happens? What does TSA do? What's going on?
It gets stuck in TSA. It gets stuck in TSA and it never gets spread apart into different parts of the brain. It all stays together and it gets imprinted in your amygdala. Because trauma is an experience that the emotions are so high that we can't handle them. And so it never makes it past the amygdala. And so the whole memory gets stored as like this one giant clump. And here's why that matters. Because it doesn't get dispersed. That means that anything that reminds you of any of those sensory experiences from that traumatic experience. So let's say, okay, let's talk about math.
Let's do an example.
Right. Yeah. So do you want to give one? You want me to give one?
Yeah. Like, let's say like classic example, you're asked to do like stand up in front of the class and do your mad minutes and you do it and you forget something and the class laughs at you.
Okay, great.
And you pee your pants. I'm not saying this happened to me.
Oh no.
I'm not saying it didn't happen to me either. Go on.
Did that happen to you?
I can't. I mean, I'm winking.
Okay.
It did happen to me in grade one,
oh
and I peed my pants.
Gosh.
Yeah, I know. David's shocked. I peed my pants twice in grade one. That was the first time. The second time was because I was too embarrassed to raise my hand to say I had to go to the bathroom, and then I peed all over my chair and pretend I'd spilled like water everywhere. That's normal, right? Kids do that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Okay, anyways, but the first time, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's, yes, this is a great example. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
It's okay. I moved on.
Okay.
Well, but have I? I don't know. Let's see.
Right. So that experience gets implanted in your amygdala. So anytime any part of that is remembered, so it could be, you know, you being in front of a room and everyone's laughing at you. even though it's not connected to that specific mm-hmm. experience, the laughter triggers that traumatic memory and it all comes back. The trauma comes back. Mm. It could be you standing in front of a room asked to read your answers to something. It could be, you know, any of these things that might, so like with PTSD, with trauma, it could be the barbecue in someone's backyard, like the little flame in a barbecue that triggers the explosion when they were out on the war field. Mm-hmm. Because the sensory experiences are all connected and then didn't get dispersed. So one little piece triggers the whole thing again.
So when we think about math, just because I feel like some people might be like, this is such a leap, but it's like, no, yeah. like imagine we're talking about my experience, fine. And yep. then anytime, for example, a teacher calls on you to answer a question in front of the class, it might spark that like, oh my God, I have to speak publicly. And you're back in that peeing your pants spot.
Yes.
And you can never, you always stumble and you feel so uncomfortable and, or you start crying when you have to like answer the question.
Yes. And so why it matters so much is because when the whole memory comes flooding back, the amygdala, remember the amygdala is there to keep you safe. And so it's going to shut down everything else in your brain. So when the trauma is triggered or relived, then it shuts down the learning centers of the brain and students aren't able to learn.
So it's twofold because it's like, okay, yes, on the one hand, first of all, like both are bad. Like it's, yes, shutting down the learning centers is obviously not ideal for learning math, but also like the child is experiencing horrible emotions that they had once experienced before. Right? There's like two things going on that are both bad.
Yes.
Damon just held up the phone with a note saying, is this why you're always so stressed when you have to present at conferences? okay, we'll have to explore that at a later date. Okay, this part is so important, I think. You've explained it so concisely and so well, and I actually think it's really, really important to not just be like, oh, like we don't want to traumatize kids because obviously, you know, that sucks. And when we do these things, like there are a lot of things that, you know, have been shown to re-trigger trauma or to cause trauma, things like calling on kids when their hands aren't up, things like speed yes. testing, this kind of stuff.
Yes, this is why it's so important as a teacher. So like, let's say I'm a high school math teacher. And I have no idea what type of math trauma my yeah. students are bringing with them. Whatever happened, this is why it's so important for us to explore our math stories with each other, to share, because I don't know that like flipping on my doc cam is going to trigger a past traumatic experience with a student that they had when they were in sixth grade math. I don't know what it was, but it could be something. And this is why it's important for us to explore these experiences. The way we heal from trauma is to, you know, you can't like hide or suppress them. They're there. Mm-hmm. You need to create a safe space for people to explore their past experiences with math and simultaneously infuse it with new joyful experiences.
So can I
which is exactly what you do in your tutoring center.
Well, I love this. I love this so much. And I always, so whenever I'm, you know, speaking to teachers about this, I talk about this. I'm like, it's impossible to know what everyone's coming into the classroom with, right? So what are some strategies we can use? And one of the things I talk about is making a classroom math agreement. Like, have you ever, right? Where you yeah. like ask mm-hmm. everyone, you're like, what are things you like about math in a group? What are things you don't? Let's kind of negotiate. So maybe some kids might say something like, I really hate when kids speak over me, or I really hate when I'm being rushed. That gives you a chance to kind of like sneakily gauge what traumas mm-hmm. they might be coming in with. But also yeah. like if one person has experienced it, the chances are more people have. What do you think about that as a strategy? And do you have any other strategies for teachers who are like, how can I kind of figure it out?
Yeah. So I'm writing a whole book on it that's going to have a collection of lots of different activities for teachers to do just that. So it depends on the grade level. For younger grades, so within middle school, what I'm doing right now with middle schoolers is we're graphing our math journey. So from K oh. through wherever they are, sixth grade, eighth grade. And we talk about it in terms of a relationship, your relationship with math. Relationships are complicated. And there's times when we're really in love with math. And then there are times when we break up with math. And so they take this graph, like K through six, and like, what was your relationship with math like? And we just use emojis as our axis points of like happy face, neutral, and then like, ugh. And what I love about this activity is it gives me a visual of how their math journey has been. And then I ask them if I can do either conferencing with them or have them do a little bit of a writing of just, hey, label the high point and label the low point. Tell me what was going on there that made you fall in love with math. Who was your teacher? What was going on? What were they doing? And then this low point when you had like a total breakup with math, what was happening there? Because that also gives me that information. But what I also love about that graphing experience is that it completely feeds the ideas we were talking about earlier around neuroplasticity and growth mindset of like, look, your experience with math is not static. It's not a plateau. It's changing and the future will continue to change. Here's some tools to help keep it up and high. So then another thing that I like to do with maybe more high school students is it's actually an idea that was taken from Sarah Strong, who wrote a book with one of her students, Gigi Butterfield, called Dear Math, where students actually write a letter to math and talk about the relationship that they have with math and what they think and how they feel about math. And then it's really therapeutic and it gives me a lot of information about their experiences with math and what is triggering for them. We have to be able to talk about this. Otherwise, here I come in with 180 students who have all unique different experiences with math and I have no idea where they're at and how I can help them heal so that I can help them grow. Because if we don't heal first, the growing is either going to be slow or painful or non-existent at all.
So I have a final question, which is something I've been toying with a lot and trying to decide how I feel. And I see this in rooms when I talk to teachers about this. How do you feel about all of the stuff you're talking about, but a teacher trying to carry this out who might not have done any mindfulness themselves? They might have never seen a therapist. This isn't something you get. This isn't a part of a teacher training, any of the socio-emotional stuff. Do you think teachers need to do something or be certified in some way or get trained in some way or know something before they carry out activities like this? Or do you think it's like any teacher can do this?
That's a great question. I have the same question myself. I think, but so there's different levels, right? Yeah. If you really want to heal trauma, then you probably should find a trained clinical psychologist who can do like EMDR with you. And so we need to, when we serve teachers, like you and I and the work that we do, and when we serve teachers, it's not like an all or nothing. And we can't let great be the enemy of good. And that
love,
you know,
I needed to hear that right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so like anything is better than nothing.
Okay.
And we're going to continue to grow. Like you said, these are new realms that we're in. It's in the last few years, last decade, when we're opening up and seeing the need for this type of things. And so anything is better than nothing. So even if you have students graph, have them like do a short paragraph writing, even just like putting emojis in terms of how they're feeling about math, just finding ways to bridge in the emotional aspects and their relationship with math is all going to be helpful. But the thing is that so many teachers are bringing in their own math anxiety and their own math trauma, which is really contagious. Really, really contagious.
So it's like maybe they need to do that work themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like, I'm also working on a course for teachers who are, it's, you know, partially healing your own math trauma. And we know that a lot, like a lot of elementary teachers and teachers that aren't necessarily trained in math and aren't math specialists have that. And I think, I was talking to Deborah Peart, I was mentioning before, and she does a lot of mindfulness and math. That's kind of her thing. And I know this is so hard. It's like we're limited for time and all sorts of things. But she was like, it's kind of hard to be teaching kids about mindfulness when you don't have your own mindfulness practice or have never done it, right? Like, how can you come in and be like, guys, let's all get grounded when you're like, I don't know how to do that myself. And I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's like there's such a need, and good thing we're both working on it, but there is such a need for resources for teachers, because I find this, we tell teachers to just start teaching socio-emotional learning and just get right into it. We give them an hour of PD and it's like, this is a whole new concept. It's a whole new way to approach a math classroom. Sometimes I'm just kind of like, not nervous, but I can feel that teachers in the room are nervous when they're like, I've never done any of this stuff myself. Like, I don't want to cause damage, but I guess like in a way it's like, we're already causing damage.
Right. We're just trying to cause less damage. And anything with the socio-emotional learning, the research is so clear that, I mean, I used to write a bunch of curriculum, and I do. I like write a bunch of SEL curriculum and students take it. But the research is so clear that the best way to learn that is just to be surrounded by people who model it.
Yes.
And so we can't just, and same thing with growth mindset. We can't like
help students have a growth mindset if the teachers don't have a growth mindset?
Totally.
And don't believe that the students have the ability.
Yes. I always end my presentations with a Ted Lasso. Wait, have you seen Ted Lasso?
No.
Liesl, okay. I mean, that's a lot. Okay, but
we talked about this, didn't we? It's the F words. I want to watch it so bad. I just need to edit this. Too many F words.
Right. That's right. They do swear a lot in it.
A lot.
They do. They're a football team. Anyways, the point is, my last slide is always the greatest thing you can do as a teacher is just believe. Like genuinely yes. believe in it, because your students can tell if you don't. You can talk about growth mindset as much as you want, but unless you're internalizing it and embodying it, it's all just lip service.
There's tremendous research to support that. 100% true.
Okay, Liesl, we are moving on to the final two questions we ask every single guest. Question one, what is the one thing you'd like to see change about the way math is taught in schools?
Oh, jeez.
The best reaction. Like, I know there's 100, but like, what's one?
That the non-math factors matter so much more than you think. That the relationship that the teacher has with the learner, the sense of belonging that the students have, how safe students feel to fail and make mistakes, all of the non-conscious, invisible factors, those deserve your attention more than you out there searching for the most amazing math task on Google to solve that you think is going to solve all of your problems when teaching linear functions.
The hidden curriculum.
Yes.
Love it. And finally, Liesl, what do you say to someone who's like, but Liesl, I'm just not a math person?
You're wrong. wrong answer, is what my kids would say.
Okay, great. Very succinct. We'll just get that on a t-shirt. You're wrong. I love it.
No, I would probably say, wow, I'm really sorry. Like what? Tell me more. Tell me what has happened in your math experience that has led you to believe that.
Who hurt you?
Yes. Yeah. I'm taking names. Tell me where they are. Give me their address.
Okay. You are amazing. This has been so amazing. I have learned so much and you've given a whole other perspective and kaleidoscope lens with which I can now view like so much of the work I'm already doing. I really love it so much. And I think it just kind of goes to show that everything is so interconnected. And sometimes you're intuitively doing something, or maybe you're doing something from more of a like mindfulness self, like I'm really into self-help. So I think a lot of this stuff has been from that perspective, which is not often quote unquote rooted in science, but it's so nice to kind of hear like, It is.
We're slow. But the fields are merging.
Yeah.
They really, really are.
Which is so cool. And it's like, it's all one of those things that's obvious, but it just has, I love that it's coming together right in this moment on this episode. So tell us, where can we all find you?
The best place probably to find me would be Twitter. That's where I'm most active on social media. You can also find me on my website, which is lieselmcconchie.com. Check the show notes for spelling. And yeah, I just have a lot of videos and free resources and things that I put out there, and a workshop on motivation, the science of motivation, and how we can support that with our classroom students.
What a treat. Oh my God. I'm so glad I was eating a sandwich on the floor of that hallway that one day. This has been amazing. It has been such an honor. I'm such a huge fan. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Okay, I cannot stop thinking about how my brain is different now than it was at the beginning of this episode. Like, that will never not be exciting to me. So the thing is, we recorded this interview before the math therapy team visited a Michigan prison for Pi Day, which you might have heard me reflect on in a bonus episode before season 5 launched. And if you didn't, you should totally listen to it because it's wild. But the point is, this thought of, you know, our brains being different was fresh in my mind that day. So I shared it with the inmates at the end of the event, and it was so empowering for them. They were all like, oh my God, I felt my brain change. You know, the thing is, technical terms like neuroplasticity can sometimes feel a bit out of reach. So to hear from a brain expert that we can literally just change our brains as we learn was super empowering for me too. If something in this episode inspired you, please tweet us at Math Therapy. And you can also follow me personally at The Math Guru on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Math Therapy is hosted by me, Vanessa Vicaria. It was created by me and Sabina Wex, and it's produced and edited by David Coachberg. Our theme music is by Goodnight Sunrise. And guys, if you know someone who needs math therapy or just needs to hear someone else getting math therapy, please, please, please share this podcast and rate or review it on whatever podcast app you use. Those things actually make such a big difference for us. I'm determined to change the culture surrounding math, and I need your help. So spread the word. Until next time, peace, love, and pie.